by your good fortune and ours, the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself, with all his plenary portions, such as Baladev, is now within your womb. Therefore, you need not fear Kamsa, who has decided to be killed by the Lord. Your eternal son, Krishna, will be the protector of the entire Yadu dynasty.
O Mother Devaki,
by your good fortune and ours,
the Supreme Personality of Godhead himself,
with all his plenary portions such as Baladev, is now within your womb. Therefore you need not fear Kamsa,
who has decided to be killed by the Lord.
Your eternal son, Krishna, will be the protector of the entire Yadu dynasty. The words Paramahamsa Akshena signify that Krishna is the original Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is the verdict of the Shastra, Krishna's true Bhagavan Svayam. Thus the demigods assure Devaki, your son is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is appearing with Baladev, his plenary portion. He will give you all protection and kill Kamsa, who has decided to continue his enmity toward the Lord and thus be killed by him. Prayers which are offered by the demigods to Lord Krishna, who is in the womb of Devaki. So these prayers are being offered by the demigods such as Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. They appeared in the prison chamber along with Devaki and Vasudev to offer these prayers. And similarly, demigods appeared at the time of the advent of Lord Chaitanya and offered various prayers, which were heard by Jagannath Misra and his wife. And actually, talking to one fellow about that just the other day. And also the question came up of the role of the Brahma-jyoti in the process of creation. So actually it's described in the Brahma-samhita that the Brahma-jyoti, or Brahman, is actually the source of creation. So Srila Prabhupada also points out in the purport in the second canto that this is the case, and he explains it in an interesting way. He makes the point that this Brahma Jyoti, which is the effulgence of Krishna, is the vehicle by which Krishna transmits seedling forms of all kinds of different created manifestations. So he actually makes the point there that one shouldn't expect Krishna to have to create using a hammer and other instruments the way a blacksmith does it. So actually you can consider the way that human beings create things is ultimately to use their hands. And the process can become quite complicated, especially when you want to create very small things. So Krishna doesn't have to use such methods. And the basic idea of how the creation is carried out is that this, referring to this idea of the Brahmajyoti, this Brahmajyoti is described as the effulgence emanating from the transcendental body of Lord Krishna. And typically, it is described as being undifferentiated. So, the well-known Mayavadis like to take advantage of this idea that Brahmajyoti is undifferentiated. And they take undifferentiated in the strictest sense possible, meaning that the Brahmajyoti does not have any qualities of difference between one part and another in any respect. So, according to this conception, this Brahmajyoti is the ultimate oneness. So the idea is that it's free of duality. Of course, duality means two. So, the idea there is that in the Brahmajyoti there cannot be two things that can be distinguished from one another. So, that's one conception of what it means for something to be undifferentiated. However, there's a much less extreme conception of what that would mean. Namely, you have something that's more or less uniform and homogeneous in nature. For example, if you look at a large amount of water as in the ocean, you can say, reasonably, that that is undifferentiated. Because everywhere you look, the water is the same. And water by nature is quite uniform. So that any little part of it in any place that you put your sample in, it's of the same nature. Or likewise, if you consider a region of outer space with sunlight pouring through it, you say that that field of sunlight is undifferentiated. In the sense that the sunlight is the same everywhere within that region. However, at the same time, there's differentiation there, strictly speaking. Because, for example, the sunlight is going in one direction, namely it's going from the sun outwards, and it's not going in all the other possible directions. So that means you have a differentiation there. It's coming out from the sun, not going into the sun. And likewise, even in the ocean, one would say that, well, if you look closely enough, you'll see that there are molecules of water. So they're differentiated from one another. So the same idea actually applies to the Brahmajyoti as described in the Vedic literature. First of all, the Brahmajyoti is the effulgence of Krishna, and it's emanating from the body of Krishna. Then, that's a differentiation right there. Because it's not coming from infinity and going into the body of Krishna. That's not the way it's described. Nor is it emanating from something else. And another alternative is that it could be just emanating from nothing at all. It could be just there. But since it's described as emanating from the body of Krishna, that means that there is differentiation in the Brahmajyoti. And furthermore, we understand that there are innumerable spirit souls situated within this Brahmajyoti. So that's comparable to the molecules in the water. Just as the water has innumerable molecules in it, and they're all distinct. So likewise, the Brahmajyoti is occupied by innumerable spirit souls. So that's also differentiation. And in fact, it's a greater degree of differentiation than exists in the water, at least as far as the scientific understanding of water is concerned. Because according to the scientific conception, any two H2O molecules, assuming that their atomic nuclei are all of the same isotope, and so hydrogen and oxygen, are exactly identical. That is, there is literally no difference between, say, one proton and another proton. They're identical in every possible respect. This is the concept of modern physics. But in the actual Brahma-jyoti, all the different spirit souls are individual by nature. They all have different desires. They're in different states of consciousness. And they will all have different future histories. Also, that they had different past histories. So, that means that within the Brahma-jyoti, there's even greater differentiation than a mass of water, let's say. So, Srila Prabhupada points out in explaining this verse in the Brahma Samhita, that verse describes that from this Brahma Jyoti, which is unlimited and absolute and is the effulgence of Krishna, innumerable planetary systems are generated with all their various variegated features. So, Srila Prabhupada points out that what happens there is that seedling forms of all the different manifestations are present within this Brahma Jyoti, or they're transmitted through it. And then these forms, under appropriate circumstances, grow and develop into complete manifestations. And this is superintended by living entities such as Brahma, who act as gardeners. So the analogy here is that if you have some seeds and you have a suitable garden and also a gardener, you can plant the seeds in the garden and then they will grow and will get different kinds of plants. So this is quite a remarkable process. Now here we're talking about not the spirit souls exactly. We're talking about the material forms. Krishna says, Bijamam Sarva Bhutanam. And Bhutanam there refers to the different manifestations. In the Bhagavad Gita, that's translated as I'm the seed of all existences. But essentially, it refers to the material embodiment of the living entities. So, the idea then is that on a very subtle level, there are seeds. So we use the word seed here as an analogy, because the seeds we know of are gross material entities. And it's actually quite a remarkable thing that a single seed, when put in the appropriate situation, can manifest a complete organism. The example is often given in the Vedic literature of the seed of a banyan tree. Apparently, it's very small. They have very tiny seeds. But the banyan trees can become extremely large. So, and likewise, from a single fertilized egg, you can produce a whole human being if it's within the womb under the appropriate circumstances. So, this is Krishna's arrangement. And actually, in modern science, people are trying to figure out how it works simply on the material level. For many years, the biochemists and so on have been studying the process whereby, say, a fertilized germ cell manifests a complete living organism. And they have many theories about it, of course, but no one really knows how that happens. For example, when the fertilized egg first begins to develop, it splits into 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, and so on cells. So soon you have a lump of cells. And here you have the problem that they seem to be undifferentiated. Come back to this question of things being undifferentiated again. Because it seems that all the cells are the same. For example, they all have exactly the same DNA. And the only difference between one cell and another is that one cell might be near the center of the lump and another one might near the outside. So, how is it that these cells then manage to develop different destinations so that one cell will become part of the liver in the future? That is, it will be the ancestor of all the liver cells, let's say. And another cell will become the ancestor of all the brain cells, and so on. So you run into this problem at every stage in the development of the embryo, actually. For example, let's say one cell somehow has decided that it's going to become the ancestor of the brain cells, and the other cells have made their respective decisions. So after that cell is divided a bit, you then have another lump of cells that are all the same. So they then have to decide what part of the brain they're going to make. That is, certain cells are going to form the cerebellum, and others will decide to form the medulla oblongata, and so forth. So how do they decide that? And then, to make it worse, according to the modern conception, the brain is like a computer in which the nerves are compared to wires and transistors and so forth. So that means the nerve cells have to connect together to form circuits or networks with a very specific pattern. For example, sometimes you may see magnified pictures of these silicon chips that they use to build computers. You see a very intricate arrangement of wires crisscrossing in various ways. Well, that has to be very carefully designed. You can't just connect them any old way, helter-skelter, or you'll never get something that works. They have to be connected together in a very precise plan. So how is it that the nerve cells or neurons in the brain know how to connect up with one another? Imagine a given neuron, which is just growing. It starts out as a spherical cell, but then it grows these long, thin processes called axons and dendrites and so on. So one nerve cell has to grow, say, an axon and connect with another appropriate neuron somewhere in the brain. And that may be several inches long, actually. Actually, some neurons have axons that go for several feet. They go right down the spinal cord and down into your leg or something like that. So this is a cell doing that. So it has to grow and then make the right connection. So how does it know where to go? Which direction to grow in and what to connect with? And it's estimated now that there are about 10 billion cells in the brain. And somebody said that out of those 10 billion cells, at least 100 billion are located in a certain ganglion in the brain. So, you're faced with a rather formidable problem. Even if somebody says, well, they don't have to line up exactly, there's room for freedom there. The choice still seems to be a formidable task to connect up all those neurons. So how does it happen? Well, somehow or other, all the potential for doing that is stored in this original fertilized egg. Even the scientists will agree that that must be true. So, but they don't really understand how it works. It's a really incredible structure. Actually, there's a kind of nematode worm. It's a very tiny little worm, which has only about 100 cells. It's one of the smallest multicellular organisms that exists. So the scientists have thought, well, this is a fairly simple organism. So we'll try and figure out just how it grows from the egg. So they've spent years studying what each cell does as this thing develops. And they still haven't figured out how this worm develops. Even though I'm sure a lot of doctoral dissertations have been written on it by now. Of course, this kind of thing is great for graduate students. They work on this and get their PhD. And then they can become professors and have students who will work on similar things and get their PhDs. They can then go on like that. And eventually they yell at it. That's one way to live. So, if you want to waste your life completely. So anyway, similarly, Krishna, since time immemorial, has on the spiritual level generated seeds for all the different manifestations within the universe. And evidently, it's described that he transmits these through the Brahma-jyoti. Even that isn't so hard to understand if you think of the idea of radio transmission going through outer space. In that example, if you have a radio in a certain place, radio transmission comes through, and then you can hear the program, so that becomes manifest. So similarly, if you have a Brahma in a certain location, he can pick up the transmission coming through the Brahma Jyoti, and he can manifest the whole universe. So it's really not such a difficult conception, but it involves the idea that the Brahma Jyoti is by no means strictly undifferentiated. It's undifferentiated in the same way that the space that the radio transmission is coming through is undifferentiated. Of course, that's not really undifferentiated, because if you look closely, you'll see that this part of the radio transmission is here, and this other part is back there. And another part is still further back, let's say. So it's not really strictly undifferentiated. So the Bhagavatam and the Vedic literature in general, Brahma Samhita and so on, presents actually a reasonable idea of how the creation comes about. In terms of basic principles, it's not an unreasonable thing. The idea is that you have an original information source, which is Krishna, and he transmits information in a very subtle form, namely these spiritual seeds. And they begin to create manifestations on the subtle platform by the arrangement of Krishna. Because Brahma, of course, is entirely on the subtle platform. Said that his body is made of intelligence, one of the separated energies of Krishna, the intelligence energy. Then there are successive stages of manifestation going from subtle to gross. So it's described that Brahma generates from his mind various living beings called Prajapatis. These are also very powerful demigods. Not as powerful as Brahma, but nearly as powerful. And the Prajapatis, in turn, generate different demigods. Of course, Brahma also directly generates various demigods. For example, it's described that once Brahma was looking in the water, just sort of contemplating his reflection. And from his mind, there manifested a whole category of demigods who were dedicated to glorifying Brahma. So Brahma has a pretty powerful mind. Imagine a couple we didn't do if we had minds like that. You know, it's bad enough if you just start looking in the mirror and thinking, wow, that's me. But imagine if, as soon as you thought that, a whole host of beings were manifested and began singing your glories. It could create a difficult situation. So anyway, the Prajapatis are manifesting. They then create different demigods. At a certain point, the mode of manifestation goes from mental creation to sexual reproduction. But at each stage, what's happening is these seeds are being transmitted from one form to another. So at one stage of creation, it's described that the daughters of Daksha were giving birth to all kinds of different living beings. Of course, and that seems like a somewhat strange story when you first hear it, because you hear that a certain daughter of Daksha gave birth to predatory birds, and another one gave birth to serpents, and that was Kadru, actually, and another one gave birth to cloven-hooved beasts, and so on. This seems a bit strange, according to our normal experience. But actually, the principle behind it is easy enough to understand, because if from Daksha these daughters obtain different subtle seedling forms for different kinds of organisms, then naturally they can manifest the different bodily types. And actually, what you have in this process of successive creations is successive specialization. That is, Brahma receives seeds which you can use to create anything in the universe. Prajapatis receive a more limited selection. I don't know the details, obviously. But at a certain point, once a rhinoceros has been created, that rhinoceros can only reproduce more rhinoceroses. It's simply limited in that way. However, if you look at what happens when the fertilized egg for the rhinoceros develops, you'll see a further process of successive specialization occurring. This has been noted by the scientists. What happens is that an initial cell in what's called the blastula form for the rhinoceros has the potential power to become any part of the rhinoceros. In fact, you can show that. Well, they don't do it with rhinoceroses because they're a bit bulky, but they use frogs and sea urchins, especially sea urchins. These are favorite. But if you take one cell out of the blastula and put it by itself, it'll grow into a complete organism. And you can do that at a surprisingly late stage. Up to a certain point, you can pick out one cell and it becomes a complete organism. But then, what happens is the cells somehow become specialized. They narrow down their abilities so that at a certain point, if you pick out a liver cell, it can form a complete liver, assuming you can keep it going, so it can do that. But it can't form anything else. And so the cells eventually become so specialized that a certain cell in the eye, let's say, can produce, say, corneal tissue. And it can't produce anything else. So this process of successive specialization of original general information takes place even when the embryo is developed. So a similar thing takes place in the creation. So actually, this conception of the creation in Vedic literature is quite sensible. And it's a reasonable alternative to the scientific idea, which is that matter just gets it together by itself. Somehow atoms just bouncing together form more and more complicated shapes until eventually the human beings, which is a little bit, and that's of course a whole discussion. I won't go into it today. But it's a theory that has its drawbacks, to say the least. So someone could say, yes, but really, to say that God did it is, first of all, it's just a cop-out, and that's fantastic anyway, and it's a superstition that went out with the Dark Ages. It's the basic kind of reaction that people are trained these days to give. But actually, the process of creation is described in Vedic literature. If you look at it in terms of general principles, it's a sensible process. Not only that, it allows for the possibility of scientific investigation. Because one charge the scientists will make is that these ideas from religion are sterile. They don't result in any kind of development of further knowledge. You either accept them or you don't. You either have blind faith in the dogmas put forth in these scriptures, or else you don't have blind faith in them, and that's it. You can't go any further. But actually, if you wanted to scientifically study this process of creation described in Vedic literature, at least at the lower stages of the process, as you come closer to the gross manifestation, there are a lot of things you can immediately think of studying. For example, in one purport in the third canto, where it's describing the nature of the etheric element, Srila Prabhupada points out that the element ether is, so to speak, the connecting link between the three subtle separated energies of Krishna and the five gross energies. Actually, ether is one of the five gross energies. So ether connects the mind element with the other gross elements. So the mind element, which is a subtle energy, imposes forms within the ether. And then the ether, in turn, affects the gross manifestations of air, fire, water, and earth. And vice versa, the air, fire, water, and earth obviously will have an effect on the ether, and that in turn affects the mind. So it's like a communicating link. So that means there are forms in the ether. And it's also described that within the body, the pattern of the veins and so forth corresponds to the forms generated within the ether. And maybe this is a clue telling how the whole bodily arrangement takes place. As I was saying, that's a bit mysterious. But anyway, Srila Prabhupada said that this is a subject for great scientific research work. And actually, if you think about it, one could try to investigate the ether and show that there is such a thing and that complex forms could be manifested in it. And then this leads to another whole subject. What time is it?
Six.
I'm not kidding about the whole subject. For example, if cells were described in Srila Prabhupada as essentially living, independent living entities, he would say, well, yeah, they have souls. They're living entities. But on the other hand, Ravindra Sroop once described cells as sort of rips in the wall. For example, if you look at epithelial tissue, you'll see that's the essential structure that it has. All the cells are like little, effectively like bricks arranged in a sheet. And so then Srila Prabhupada responded by giving the analogy of the apartment, saying the body is comparable to an apartment, and the soul is like the tenant in that apartment. So the tenant is the actual living entity. You don't say the apartment is alive. So that shows that there's different ways of looking at it. Now, it is conceivable that in something like epithelial tissue, all the cells could just be units that have been reproduced to form a structure without souls in them. On the other hand, there are the white blood corpuscles that are just like living independent entities that move around by themselves. And of course, all of these cells can live independently. You can even take a skin cell and put it in culture medium, sufficient nutrients, and it will just grow into a lump. And it will keep growing as long as you provide food for it. In fact, there are people who died many, many years ago whose cells are still living in culture mediums. So I wonder if they're still attached to those cells. In fact, people's cancers still are living long after the people were killed by them. They keep them growing in culture mediums to study the process of cancer formation. So it's not completely clear. Now, it is clear that when a cell divides, say it is a separate living entity, like an amoeba, another soul either comes in or is promoted from a semi-conscious state to become the soul of that cell. Likewise, you can take a plant. Now, a plant has a soul, but it's well known that if you take part of the plant, plant it separately, if you do that right, it'll grow into a whole new plant. So, also there are certain worms. You can cut them in half, and the tail will grow a new head, and the head will grow a tail, and now you have two worms. So in those cases, a cell either is brought in from outside, or a cell in a lower state of consciousness within the organism is promoted to become the soul of that organism. So these kinds of things are going on. Anything else? Yeah?
If there are souls, and we know that where there's a soul, there's also a super soul. So the correct one, let's say, so maybe one can say that the code is giving to the soul the source of natural information to all these things.
Well, the super soul is there, all right. In fact, the super soul is present in every atom and between the atoms also. But this process of development of the organism, as I was describing, Krishna has a system for doing that. So I was describing the system. Apparently the system is not that he just creates it from scratch right then and there each time. Krishna could do that too if he wanted. But that's not the way he does it. Instead he devises this system with the arrangement of the seeds which can grow and so on and so forth. That's the system that he uses.
Arrivo.